Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. What is love? And does it mean what it used to? Writer and bachelor John Bowe and his team set out across the country to get some answers. They spoke with tortured teenagers, free-spirited octogenarians, anxious Navy wives, Amtrak conductors, and mail-order brides, made a kind of oral history of brutally honest and sometimes painful conversations about the first loves, infidelities, improbable reunions, and enduring passions they found. This hour On Point, real American love stories. You can join the conversation. What's new or old with love? Is our definition changing? Our expectations? What's your craziest love story? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is John Bowe, editor of the new book, Us, Americans Talk About Love. John Bowe, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, John.
Great to have you. How many people did you talk to, you and your crew?
Oh, wow. I think we talked to hundreds.
And you picked out of those hundreds the stories of those you say that that had stories on the basis of whether their interview augmented our understanding of romantic love, which is to say it did. What did you learn? It's not the same old story? Fight for love and glory? Smoke in your eyes?
No, it's never the same old story. You know, it varies from person to person. It depends. Certainly, we learned that people who have been in love and married for 60 years have a different outlook than people who are just beginning. And it was fascinating to me to hear from people who had had the same job their whole lives and lived in the same town or had a relatively stable life for 60 years, because I think for people my age, which is 45 on downwards, the idea of that kind of stability is long gone. And so that's one thing about the modern world and the modern economy that I think definitely affects our ideas of love.
Do you think that that has changed expectations of love itself? If you don't have the same job for life, you won't have the same love for life somehow?
I don't think it's changed expectations, but I think it's changed our ability to kind of follow through with them.
That the whole pattern of steadiness, of long-termness in anything in life is not as, what, hospitable, not as ready-made for love?
Yeah, I guess the simple answer to that would be yes. I don't think it's quite as hospitable. I mean, people are just as enthusiastic and romantic as they ever were.
It's interesting. You say that, that the heart of the compact between two lovers is a mystery code. And if you find that, get that, or maybe create that, you say it's transformative, life-affirming, redeeming. But you say it could well be a ghost. What does that mean?
Okay. Well, there's a great example in the book, this guy named Dominic Sclafani, who becomes a crystal meth addict with his girlfriend, China. And he talks about the things that they did together, and they make no sense to the rest of us. He talks about they would stay up for 30 hours in a row drawing and working on the same drawing while high on speed and listening to music. And he would just say the stuff of, oh, we would sit there and listen to the notes and pick out the notes and pick out the lines and imagine the singer and the band like they were on a stage. And then we would hallucinate, you know, we would see methane and see oxygen, and you can do this when you don't fall asleep for days in a row. And it's not really a hallucination. It's really the way your optical nerves work. And we would create balls of magnetism, and I would direct this with my mind around the room, and she would follow them. So we just played a lot of cool games like that, and none of my other girlfriends did anything like that, so it was really cool. Now, this sounds silly to the rest of us because we weren't
great
there.
Great balls of magnetism, yeah.
And presumably we're not meth addicts. But this guy was ruined when the relationship was over. And 7 years after, he's still bemoaning the fact, and he's living in his mother's basement on disability, clearly still mooning over this woman. And I would argue that he's no different from the rest of us, whether it's people talking about their love as Christians and the life that they share and the understanding that they share, the rhythm that they share, or people who are in polyamorous affairs where they have multiple sex or romantic partners. It doesn't matter. The stuff that people share is sort of inexplicable to anyone else.
You've got lots of stories here. I wish you'd read one for us. There's a Carla here who had a kind of on-again, off-again in Malvern, Arkansas, just to get a flavor of the kind of stories people told you. Could you read some of that for us, John?
Sure. She was a great example of one of the more positive stories in that she got nothing from birth or early childhood. She got pregnant and had a kid in high school. She was terrorized by her family, who didn't let her out of the house during her last few months of being pregnant, terrorized by gangs in high school. She ended up giving the kid up immediately for adoption, and then got into a very short-lived, horrible marriage with a guy who ended up getting all drugged out. And then she had 16 years with no real relationship. And then she fell in love with this Stetson-wearing cowboy dude named Mason Cogdell. So here she's discussing their rocky beginnings. Mm. She said, "When we were first married, he would leave me at 2 o'clock in the morning. He would pack his bags and say it wasn't working out. We wouldn't be arguing or anything. He just didn't trust anymore. He was very skeptical about relationships. His first wife was once intimate with his best friend while Mason was in the backyard. So this went on for 2.5 years until I finally told him, 'I can't take this anymore. The next time you pull that, I'll divorce you.' He packed up his stuff and left, and I divorced him. He made a lot of phone calls to my neighbor and my mother. He tried to come back over one day. His eyes were just red, and he'd been crying all the time. He was all tore up. My life didn't seem to be anything either. I didn't feel complete or nothing, but I didn't trust him to stay. And then about 9 months later, I turned on one of the music boxes that he gave me, and it was just like God was telling me it was time for us to get back together. So I called him up, and I went over there to his house. He had grown his hair halfway down his back, and he was really skinny. He looked terrible. He was depressed, and he told me he prayed every day for me. It was pretty upsetting. So I took him out to JCPenney's beauty salon and got him all cleaned up, and we were back together again. We decided to remarry."
And there's love, Carla and Mason. In Arkansas, again and again, people are opening up to you about all kinds of stories here. What did you find was the secret to getting people to become candid about what is, I guess, the most intimate aspect of most people's lives?
I don't think there's any one secret, but because we had a group of people working on this book, and it wasn't just me. But for me, I've been hitchhiking around and hopping freight trains and traveling around the world and working as a journalist all over the world since I was a teenager. And I've gotten very good at getting people to talk to me. And I think part of that is just making it clear. Number one, I've seen everything. Number two, I've done almost everything. So there's nothing you can say that's going to make me shocked. And there's nothing you can say that's going to make me judge you. And just to convince people every once in a while, you need to give something of yourself. You can't just go in and extract from them. You need to show them, look, I'm a screw-up too. You know, no one's perfect at this stuff. And I think that helps people feel a lot more comfortable.
Lay it on the line. You say, you're right. We learned from our investigations that love means intercepting your partner when you hear her cocking the pump shotgun to kill herself. Love is smoking crystal meth together and marveling at visions of nitrogen. Love is healing after infidelity. Love is acceptance. Love is listening. Love is not being able to live without the other person. It's all kinds of things. Is there something that makes, you know, one thing love and something else not love? Is there an exclusionary principle here?
Well, we did have an exclusionary principle, which was it didn't matter if the rest of us thought, oh boy, this person is messed up, or oh boy, this is a dumb kind of love, or something like that. But what had to be credible was that each person thought, this is real, this is romantic love, this is my definition of it. And they had to be able to talk about it for a while.
And you found in many cases they had to be able to create it. It's not like it's something that just fell down from the heavens onto them. It was a very actively generated state of being.
Correct. And actually, you know, at the beginning when people were asking me if I had learned anything, I kept resisting that. And now I would kind of go on to say, I think it's almost like there are two kinds of love. One is the kind you inherit or you win the lottery and you just get it and it's great. And the other kind is the created kind where you decide to invest in someone and you share things and you make kind of a moment-to-moment decision to accept things, to forgive things, to be honest, to be friendly, to be generous. And I don't think either of those types of love is better than the other one. I think everyone wants the first kind, and everyone's responsible for creating the second kind if they want love.
Let's get a call right here from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts, and Tara. Tara, you're on the air with John Bowe.
Nice to talk to you guys.
You too.
I have a story about love. I'm in love with someone named David. We met in 1994, actually, in Wyoming, in the Grand Teton National Forest. It was at a rainbow gathering, and it was the day I had gotten there. And basically, the story of love, well, okay, I don't know if you know that the Grand Teton means, like, the big nipple.
Okay, great.
Okay, so this is kind of like a loop-de-loop story, but I don't know if you've ever heard of the book I'm with the Band by Pamela DeBars.
Sure.
Okay, so I had read the book. It changed my life. Also, Hammer of the Gods, Story Led Zeppelin. So when I graduated, I was like, I'm going to California. I'm meeting Miss Pamela, you know, rock and roll. And so I found out about this gathering, and the day I had gotten there, our bus caught on fire, and then we got a vibe with somebody, and I walked through two big valleys right up to Dave. We didn't, like, get together right away, but we totally made friends.
When did you know it was love, Tara? The clock is pushing us to a break. When did you know it was love?
Basically, after we were friends, we, like, traveled together, and we, like, hooked up, and it just, I didn't know, it just kind of, it did fall from the heavens, but it was kind of the belief in the warriorship that brought me to where I belonged.
Is it still on, or is it over?
It's still on. We have, like, a 12-year-old, and it's, you know, it's my life. It's what I was here for. And actually, we're both dragons on the Chinese zodiac, and the spot that we met from the Mayan glyphs was the Emix dragon.
Wow. It's my life. It's what I'm here for. Tara, forgive me. The break has come upon us, but we've got your love story in the Grand Tetons. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about romantic love in the USA, how it's doing, and its many, many forms these days. John Bowe joins us. He's editor of the new book. It's called Us Americans Talk About Love, a kind of oral history, oral report from hundreds of interviews. They've culled out some really interesting and very diverse ones about how Americans see this thing called love these days, how they pursue it, how it maybe changes over time. We're going to hear in a few minutes from Sandra Singh Lowe, our friend, pitching in from Pasadena, California. John, I wonder if you'd give us another reading. Betty Ann May in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, another one of your many, many stories here. Married three times. She's in a trailer now, a solar-powered trailer that she hauls around to Walmart parking lots at the other end of her life, but she's happy. Tell us about her story.
Okay, well, Betty Ann May is the interview that we used to end the book. She's kind of this grand old dame living in her trailer in the Walmart parking lot, powered by solar panels, and very independent, very happy. Like you said, she was once divorced and twice widowed, and she just gave off this feeling of, I've done it all, I enjoyed it all, I'm totally happy, and now I'm completely at peace.
Okay.
when we asked her, you know, so do you care if you fall in love again? She said, nah, another piece of blank isn't worth the trouble. I'm really happy here. So anyway, she's discussing the night that she met her number two husband, Bill. And someone had introduced them at a bar. And she said, we left the bar. And I said, you know, I'm separated and I have four kids and I won't go to bed with you tonight. And he said, who asked you? And I said, you will. And he did. And I didn't. But we sat in the car and necked until I thought our skin was going to fall off. I came home that night, and the next day I told Ruth, my neighbor lady friend, I said, I found him. I said, he's a combination of, I don't know if you know who these are, but Alexander King, he's a writer, Jack Parr, the host on a talk show, and Captain Kangaroo. And that's what I got. That was Bill. I don't know if you have this for your freezer, the food salesman. Well, they were guys who went into homes and sold people food plans. You order and reorder to fill it. Well, he was in that. The first time he showed me the pitch that he gave to people, I was enchanted. I just thought, I'll buy one now. He could sell snow to Eskimos. My oldest girl couldn't stand it because I was bringing him into the house. She was 13 at the time and says, I don't want you to marry him. I want it to stay the way it is. You, me, and the kids. And I said, okay, if I can't have any friends, then you can't have any boyfriends. So that closed up. I said, first of all, I don't care whether any of you like him or not. You will respect him. I'm marrying him for me, not for you.
And that's Betty from her Walmart parking lot in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, talking about one of three that worked out at least in retrospect, for her, from this is from Us, Americans Talk About Love, John Bowe and his crew talking with a lot of folks about what it is, what they found, what they try to make of it. We've got a lot of callers, John. Vivian in Boston, you're on the air with John Bowe.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to talk about love as an extension of forgiveness, or the way that I have connected with the permanence of my love in my relationship, in my marriage, is an early story of realizing that I could forgive this person more than I could forgive anybody else that I had previously been involved in, involved with. And should I tell you the story?
Yeah, sure.
I think this is perfect. This is right there in the spine.
I had always had very combative relationships, you know, where they would kind of blow up. And usually because of being disappointed that somebody wasn't perfect. And in this relationship that evolved eventually into my marriage, which has now been 18 years, the very first fight that we had, where, you know, I stormed out of the house and I was like, it's over, he's not perfect, I'm not doing this anymore, I had to stop and get gas on the way home, you know, and I was still fuming, and I was wandering the aisles of this convenience store, and I came across brownie mix, and I suddenly decided I wanted to make him brownies. In the midst of this kind of fuming rage,
you didn't want to strangle him. You didn't want to poison him or strangle him, but make him brownies.
No, I wanted to make him brownies, and that had never in my life happened. And I realized, and I still go back to that again and again. You know this, and it was like this softening in relation to this very specific person. It wasn't because I was dreamy about him. It was because I realized that I could go back. I could make brownies for him. I could go back, and I could forgive him. And, you know, it's like a symbol for me in the marriage.
Absolutely. Vivian, thank you for your story. John, there it is, combative Vivian, who turns around and suddenly she can forgive this person anything. And there, she says, is love.
Can I read something quickly from the book?
Yeah, please.
That goes just to what she's talking about and what I was talking about before when I said it's all about actions. This is from Stephen Hager, a guy whose wife, in their second year of marriage, fell 10 feet and had a spine injury that resulted in 18 years of really, really bad chronic pain, dizziness, vomiting, suicidal depression, and many attempts at suicide, and several spells of being institutionalized. And this guy waited for his wife with zero self-pity and absolute patience for 18 years.
Wow.
And he said, I think love is basically about action, about doing something for a person. It's about choices. If you're pissy, love is a choice to not take something out on your spouse. It's a choice to not jump on their case. If you're feeling tired, it's a choice to get up anyway and do things for that person. It's a choice to have fun with this person.
I think it's brownies.
Making brownies. There it is.
If that's it. John Bowe in New York, stand by. The new book is Us, Americans Talk About Love, and we're very happy right now to have joining us from Pasadena, California, Sandra Singlow, writer, performer, radio commentator. Her article on marriage and divorce, Let's Call the Whole Thing Off, was in last summer's an issue of Atlantic Magazine. Books include Mother on Fire, and if you lived here, you'd be home by now. Sandra Singlow, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
Well, it's great to be here, and what a great discussion. And I think it goes back to what you're saying at the top of the hour, what John was saying about the stability in these lives that make these sort of loves possible. I mean, I'm 47, similar generation, and I think our generation came up, at least our creative class generation, with the idea that our passion is reserved for our jobs and our creative work. So often I find these couples that I write about and was part of that, you know, she's the writer, he's the musician, or she's the filmmaker and he's the graphic designer. And they're both in their dream when they're young people is to be creative and to get a creative job. And then they meet together and their eyes are starry over this notion that they will be two fabulous creative people doing these jobs. But the problem is then the household starts to run on two conflicting clocks that, you know, and you don't have time to make the brownies or to make that choice. And, you know, if somebody says, I'm going to get a job, I'm going to do a film shoot next month in Bali, the other person has to go, great,
right.
And high five them as they go off for a month. You know, in my case, my husband traveled 20 weeks of a year,
yeah.
And that was great. And so, and in a sense, and you see a lot of these partnerships where you have to actually not be in love with your partner in order to sustain this household, because nobody ever says if they have to go to Seattle for a month that the other person is has their hands around the ankle saying,
right.
No,
please.
Oh, you, right. I mean, that's unheard of.
I can't live without you. You wrote last summer, Sandra, you wrote, in the cluttered forest of my 40s, what I cannot authentically reconjure is the ancient dream of brides. And then the two of you can look into each other's eyes and feel that spark again. Let me put it to you, John. You hear there, you know, there's the cluttered forest of one American who, you know, with all the things that come into our lives and demand time and attention and distance, you know, found it just about too much. Did you hear that plaint, sir?
Actually, it's funny that Sandra used the word conjure, because I think that really gets to the heart of it. If you're traveling all the time and you both have these busy, crazy freelance struggles and you're poor and you're worrying about money all the time and you have no stability, it's pretty hard to conjure anything, because conjuring requires a kind of stable routine, a lot of energy, a lot of patience, a lot of will, and a lot of concentration. And you can't do that if you're jumping around to 50 different directions all the time, which I think modern people are doing a lot more than people in the past.
Well, and I think you get the adrenaline high if you are pursuing creative, passionate work. I mean, your emotions are whipped up around these projects in a way that doesn't necessarily leave space to do it with this other person.
But what about the old idea of the lightning bolt that transcends everything?
That's completely as true now as it ever was. I mean, you would be amazed at the number of people we found who literally did have love at first sight. And that's not to say half the time it's not completely wrong or it's a train wreck in the making, but people feel it all the time as much as ever.
Sandra, you open to that one, the lightning bolt?
Yeah, no, and that's kind of what happened to me in the middle of, which caused me to break up my marriage. But I think that what one has to do after that, if one is going to have this love, is to, I think as John said in that passage, keep choosing it. And saying, you know, it's kind of, I'm going to choose this no matter how difficult it's going to make everything else. And then that becomes a really antisocial choice in a way of kind of, and I think of another couple that he's a musician and they're Orthodox Jews. Actually, she's mm-hmm. one of Bob Dylan's children. It's really interesting that she mm-hmm. became an Orthodox Jew. And he always chose, they did Sabbath every week, no matter what. Mm-hmm. And so like on Friday, I guess it's Friday nights, he would not play a gig. And he's like a touring musician. And it's kind of mind-blowing that they've been together over 20 years with their household. But it's kind of like, I mean, people would normally be aghast to say, you turned down work just to keep your family. You're a musician. You should be gigging. That you have to make choices to keep it going that people might really look askance at to keep that lightning bolt thing going.
But that's great. Yes, it's
that comes back to this whole idea of a choice. If you put love first, if you put your privileged position with someone first, ahead of work, ahead of everything else, you're going to have a better chance of holding on to it. But it's really, really hard to do.
Right. And the question is that a bigger labor now than it ever was? Let's go to Lansing, Michigan, if I may. And Mike in Lansing, you're on the air.
Well, you actually just got to the definition of love that I think really merits some consideration. And that's the unselfish, loyal, and benevolent concern for the well-being of another. That definition has largely been expunged from modern dictionaries, but it's really important to see that.
The unselfish, loyal, and benevolent concern for the well-being of another. It sounds like love, Mike. You think that's not out there anymore? Surely it is.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not saying it's not out there, but that is the real test of love. If you're putting the other person ahead of yourself.
Sandra, are you ready to go with it? Thank you, Mike. Are you ready to go with that, or does the lightning bolt go wherever it goes, unselfish
well,
or not?
That's interesting because this kind of tricky, I think that is true, and it's a hard thing to fathom, and I think for women it's can be particularly tricky. I think I'd written this New York Times op-ed piece the other week about, you know, it's kind of, so if like women are the breadwinner, which I have been, then I need a partner who's like kind of the wife who's waiting for me at home, you know, with the cocktail, the martini, the Manhattan when I come home. And I think there is somehow these complicated notions of service and love and sacrifice, which I think is what love is, but to untangle sometimes the gender roles around these things so the gift doesn't become resentment is, unfortunately for women, it's a bit of a dance to work out all these. And I know that I'm able to do service for people, like with my children and my partner, and it's kind of like, but then kind of after the 21st day of service, it's like the other day I made us all go to Costco together on a Sunday, and I was screaming at everyone, like, I go, and I'm bored, you guys should come with me. So I think working out this dance is, you know, I wish I was a better person.
No indentured servitude, please. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let me get a call from Boston. Ellen. Ellen, you're on the air.
Hi there. I wanted to go back, I guess, to sort of one of the original comments that your guest made about the idea of the unstable economy having sort of a negative effect sometimes on the stability of relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience was the exact opposite. I met the man who's now my fiancé maybe a couple months before we both got laid off. And we ended up, rather than having that be a negative thing, it was sort of a catalyst, and our relationship was this catalyst for creating this huge positive change in both of our lives.
So what, a little disruption and chaos opened you up to one another?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we sort of banded together through this and ended up going on the road together for about 5 months, traveling around the world. And towards the end of that trip, he proposed. We're on a beach in Spain.
Well, that's a nice kind of unemployment.
Yeah,
they got off the work clock. They got off the dual work clock and got. I mean, that sounds amazing. Of course.
I think it's sweet.
It sounds like a movie is in the making here, Ellen. I mean, you know, everybody wants that. What do you say, John?
If the economy keeps going downhill, we'll all be tenant farmers again, so we can have that stable old time life that we used to have, and I think that'll make things a lot easier.
Well, what about now, Ellen? That you're back from the beach? Have you found jobs and stability again, or can you just tumble on in love?
You know, we came back and we both started new careers. And the traveling was wonderful, but it was also very stressful because we weren't making much money. And, you know, we couch surfed away around the world, and sometimes we didn't know where we were going to stay. But it was this kind of, I guess it was this adventure in love. And now we've both come back. We've started new lives together. We both have totally new careers, totally separate from what we had before. And, I mean, I think we have one of those kinds of loves where we just reinforce each other's dreams, and it's really wonderful.
Hey, beautiful you, right off the beach in Spain, right out of the job. Thanks for calling, Ellen. CJ in Nashville. You're on the air, CJ.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty well. What do you know?
I just had a comment about how I think that the way we fall in love hasn't really changed. I mean, you know, I don't know that much because I've only been alive since 1990, but the way I fall in love, I feel like, has been the way that humans always fall in love throughout time. It's just a natural thing that we do. And no matter how much we start Twittering and texting and using different ways to communicate with each other, I think we're still going to have that face-to-face connection and meeting with each other, you know. Right now I'm driving over to this girl's house to make her breakfast, and I don't know, that's just something we're doing, you know, face-to-face, and we're not using, you know, the social networking or anything like that.
Nice lifestyle, baby. It's late in the morning and breakfast just coming up. That's beautiful. That's service. And is it love, CJ?
It's late when you're 19.
Hey, it's terrific. Sandra, is that what you...
Keep doing it when you're 35.
Yeah, Sandra, do you need somebody on the way to your house, Sandra, to make breakfast?
Well, I have that. Sometimes I have that. Sometimes I make breakfast. But I think that this what, driving to make breakfast is really important. It's something that modern day couples should do for each other. And I my notion of a wife, where I think sometimes within couples, I use the whole example of if you bring the other person coffee in the morning. I know there can be some long term relationships, and I was within one where it's nobody's fault, but you stop bringing coffee to the other person because you don't know what they want in it anymore. Do they want Splenda? One sugar, two sugar, milk, are you 1% cream, dairy, whatever. So even dietary things can change. And I am as guilty of that as any person. So my husband would stop bringing me coffee because I would say, oh, no, I actually take it this
take
way
it
today. And he would feel rejected at my not just accepting
of
his
course,
gift of the coffee.
Impossible
and then
you.
It's like, get your own coffee.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about love in the USA and what it means now. John Bowe is with us from New York. He's editor of a new book, a big collection of Americans talking about their love lives. It's called Us, Americans Talk About Love. Sandra Singh Lo is with us as well from Pasadena, California, commentator, writer, performer, all around insight deliverer into all things human. Let's get a call from Fort Myers, Florida. Robert, you're on the air, Robert.
Hi. I could probably comment on just about everything that has been asked on the radio so far today, but mostly I want to share the story of my wife and I that covers most everything that everyone has said. We met through mutual friends, but didn't really know each other, barely even talked to each other for about a year. And then we went to a get-together that a friend of ours was hosting, and all of a sudden started talking, and the next day we started dating. 3 days later, we were engaged in first talking at that first get-together. I found out that she was enlisted in the Navy, and she was delayed entry program. We, in the little over a year before she went in, we got married twice, actually. When we got engaged, we set a date for our wedding, and we were living about 4.5 hours from Las Vegas and regularly joked that we should just elope when we found out how difficult it was to plan a wedding.
But Robert, 3 days later you were engaged. Let me just stop you right there. Why? In 3 days? How did you know? Are you crazy, or was it just so obvious?
It was just obvious. As a matter of fact, after we were engaged, usually once every couple of days, one of us would turn to the other and say, "Are you freaking out about this yet?" And we never did. We never thought that it was nuts. And actually, the friends and family that really knew us well didn't think that it was nuts either. We had quite a few friends and family that, you know, when they found out how long we'd known each other, were like, what are you doing?
But 3 days and ready to go. John Bowe, in your many, many conversations here, Robert knew after 3 days. How did people you talk to know, or when did they decide, well, this is it, it's happening now? Or
I think it's a sense, I mean, for some people, it might be sexual attraction masquerading as something else. But I think for a lot of people, even most people, it's a sense of this person understands me in a way that no one else has. Was that what happened to you?
Maybe it was. I think Robert's gone, but something clicked very quickly there. Let's get another. Ginger in Boston. Ginger, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah,
I've been trying to figure out. I'm married for the second time, which surprised me because after the first, I never thought I would do it. I'm married for the second time, and I just found myself actually today shaking my head before the show saying, I think I really love this guy. I can't figure out why, but I think I really do.
I mean, you're already married, and you're just coming to that conclusion, or?
Well, no, I mean, I felt love for him, but we've only been married a short time, and we've been together, I don't know, about 5 years. It feels like 50. It does. We joke about it. But because of some of the things that have happened and some of the things that I feel that he's put me through, it's so different. The first time was there was no question in my mind. This was it forever. And, you know, going through that disappointment of it wasn't forever. And even though he was a good person and I loved him with all my heart, it wasn't going to work out. So
can I ask what the second guy has put you through when you say that? I'm always curious.
He hasn't cheated on me or anything like that, but it's sometimes it feels like cheating of the heart. He's very secretive about communicating with friends, and there's just, he shuts me out. He can get very, very angry, and he didn't talk to me for, and I'm not kidding when I say 3 months. I'm not exaggerating.
So is this the one, or not necessarily, are you saying, Ginger?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
So is this the one, or with all that, are you...
But I think it's interesting that sometimes if we find our soulmate, which he may or may not be, it's like the soul's mirror comes up, and layers of things may come out. You know, it's like sometimes a writer friend told me recently she got married in order to escape intimacy. Often, like, if we find a partner for whom we can just be cheerful and, like, repress our feelings and life is fine. But sometimes when you meet someone that really gets under your skin, these layers of things will come. I mean, it's really hard.
John, did you find people wanting stormy passion or just that, you know, that comfort?
Oh, we found all kinds. I mean, there were some people who got together and all of their faults and all of their foibles and everything that got in the way with them having intimacy came out, you know, just in a big, huge jumble, one after another, after another, after another. There's a woman we talked to who had a lot of weight issues, a lot of childhood issues, a lot of issues with men, a lot of self-esteem issues, who hooks up with this guy who's an alcoholic, who has no money, and who has post-traumatic stress syndrome, and goes running into the closet thinking that people are going to kill him in the middle of the daytime. And they worked out their problems because, not because they were trying to so hard. It wasn't like they were taking their medicine. Their love just kind of worked on each other, and not over the course of 20 years, but over the course of 2 years, because I guess they wanted it badly enough.
Let's get a call from Stratford, Vermont, and Lori. Hi, Lori. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It's nice to be here.
Mm-hmm. What's your story, Lori?
My story is, it's a story about two dear friends, and I met them when they were in the midst of their third marriage. They had both been divorced, then had a long mid-life marriage, very happily, and both lost their wife and husband, and then they found each other at 72 and 74. And I met them when they were 84 and 86, I believe. I was working in their house, and my story is a Friday morning. Betty was showing me how to dust a table I was cleaning for them,
mm-hmm.
and 86-year-old women or 84-year-old women have a specific way to dust.
No doubt.
And
yeah.
Her husband, Carl, was in the other room, and he had, years and years and years before, played with swing bands, and he had played with Jimmy Dorsey for a short period,
mm-hmm.
and he was playing some music, and mid-sentence, she said, "Oh, I love this song. I have to dance with Carl," and she walked away and went into his office, and the door closed, and the music went up, and it was a 9:30 on a Friday morning, and they were dancing at 84 and 86. And
that's,
I think,
that's pretty great. That's what everybody wants, right?
It
is good
what
work
they
if
want.
You can get it.
And I think they had been through such hard times, both of them together, that they knew what was grand in a life and in a marriage. And they just would literally stop mid sentence and do it.
Wow, that's beautiful. It's a beautiful story, Lori. Thank you very much for that. John, you write, at one point you write, if there is an observation that becomes crystal clear in the book, it's this: the subjects who love for 6 months, 2 years, 5 years are very different from those who have loved for 50 or 60 years. Is it a generational thing? Perhaps in part.
Well, one of the things we noticed that started to worry me at the beginning was that the people who'd been together for 30, 50, 60 years had all been through some really dark stuff. I mean, depressions, wars, cancer, infidelity, people dying around them. And I just thought, wow, this is going to be an incredibly bittersweet, melancholy book. There's no real big, solid rainbow patch of anybody's life that's not colored by some of this stuff. And after a while, you realize, well, that's really, you know, the stuff of life. It's the people who get through that stuff together without murdering each other. And with an increased understanding and sense of mutual reliance.
Well,
who end up, I think, having the best bond.
You appreciate what you have. I mean, you're grateful for the things that you have, and even a normal day where you can just have some coffee together and not have, like, a bomb exploding over you.
Right.
And I think, again, generationally, our generation, the 45, 47-year-olds, it's like we have a more utopia vision of kind of like, I should have an amazing job, creative job, good money. You know, we should live in a beautiful A-frame house in Boulder, Colorado.
And I must have washboard abs.
Right. Yes, washboard abs, and then we should kind of have hot sex, and we should have a really great Chardonnay tonight. And like,
but does any of that mean, panel, Sandra, that you can't be dancing when you're 86? All that plus what Lori described.
Well, I think probably you have to put some of these things off at the table, and I think when we talked about the woman who was unemployed and they went off for, 5 months and traveled, it's like, you know, if you want to really find love, maybe you should be prepared to make less money, live in a dumpier place. I mean, and certainly you see couples who stay together just because of the real estate that they could not afford to kind of break up because they would lose their house and everything must be done to remodel the house. I mean, there's so many things that we go for, I guess, in our generation that we feel we cannot be happy without this. You know, we can't even be happy without the right bottled water or the right baby Bjorn or the right, you know, brand
right.
of Volvo.
Right.
And you have to give some of those things up, I think, so you can dance.
Do you have to be born in 1930? Yeah, please, John. Yeah.
Okay, there's a former Cambodian monk in the book who was a monk from the age of 16 to 26 when the Khmer Rouge took over Cambodia. Mm. And he had never held hands with anyone. He had never gone to a movie. You know, he had been living as a monk. And then when the Khmer Rouge took over and the Cambodian genocide started, he and everyone else were thrown onto work camps, and they were defrocked as monks, and he was forced to live like everyone else. So one day these Khmer Rouge kids, these 16-year-old kids with Kalashnikov machine guns, in their infinite wisdom, decided to take all the single men in the village and all the single women in the village and force them to get married. So that day, 60 couples were married. And this man, who was just this 80-pound skinny bag of bones, who was surviving off of eating grass and gecko lizards, is all of a sudden living in a shack, in a one-room hut with a woman who's also an 80-pound bag of bones. Mm-hmm. And he describes how he went from being someone who's trembling every night, worrying that he's going to get shot in the head the next morning for no reason at all. Now he gets to tremble with someone else. And I won't tell his whole story because it goes on for a while, but at the end of it, he says, you know, I guess true love is sort of like finding heaven. He said, it's very, very hard. You know, and now I live in Minneapolis, and, well, it's like $200 to buy a bus ticket to Washington. So if it's so difficult to get to Washington, imagine how difficult to get into heaven.
that's a long brain jump there.
But to bring it back to what we were saying, I just think that any couple, whether they're an old couple or a younger couple or this economy or that economy, there's always a way to find happiness and commitment and stability and all of these things that most of us are looking for. It's really, really difficult.
Yeah, and I
but
think part of it
you can find it.
Yeah, giving up your sense of rightness or wrongness or justification or what you deserve to have or this and that. And I think just giving it up in every moment and finding that kindness and gentleness that people talked about, that is something that has to be mindfully worked at.
We can dream. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Angela in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Angela.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to just make a comment quickly about my love story. I was engaged to be married and was going to India for business, and my fiancé thought, well, let's elope at the end of this Indian trip. And my first day in India on business, I fell in love with someone not my fiancé. And, yeah, it was difficult. But
how did that happen, Angela? That was kind of off the reservation. I mean, was it your first day? That's pretty fast.
Yeah. My first day, I was introduced to someone who was going to be working with me, and I met his eyes, and that was it.
Angels sang, the clouds opened, the beams of sunlight came down.
Absolutely. All of those things happened. So it was just a matter of extricating myself from my fiancé, which he wasn't very happy about. And then, you know, me and now my husband started to date after that, and we just recently eloped, and we live happily together in Cambridge.
So you believe in love at first sight. It's still out there.
It is, absolutely.
We'll talk about it. Let me hold that one. John in Augusta, Georgia. John, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. A little bit different story than the other lovely, happy couple. I was probably in my mid-20s when I didn't necessarily want to get married. I was just tired of dating. I met someone. 3 months later, we're engaged. 4 months after that, we're married. Business was going well. I was in the real estate development business. Times were really good, and I got the great wisdom to start my own gig. Market turned to crap. Relationship turned to crap almost parallel, and the story didn't end so well.
Is it off? Is it done? Is this the love that went away?
Yeah, I think so. She's on the other part of the country, and it started out wonderful, and I'm not sure if the economy had anything to do with it or if it were just not the right time or the right intent.
So do you believe in love in your case then, John, or is it all about the stock market and how many buildings are going up?
Yeah. I'm a cynic. I think that I've turned into this cynical guy who believes that it will happen in its time, and here I am, just had my 30th birthday, looking at possibly a second time around, and I'm just not sure I'm really up for it. It's a lot of
putting yourself out there, John. Sandra, there it is. Love at First Sight in India, and everything falling apart in Augusta. it all happens all the time, I guess, but in a new way, or just, you know, this is what it is. This is human relationship. This is the fickleness.
Well, and I think also sometimes there's not love at first sight. In my case, my Argentinian bombshell, as I like to call him, was somebody I knew for 10 years. Like, yeah, and then suddenly this kind of gate opens, and you go, oh my God, it's like a Merchant Ivory movie. Oh, it's you.
You were right there all
the
time.
This is horrible. This is horrible news. Because, you
know, and I think that process of how the gate opens is where the miracle is. I think that's really, really fascinating.
John, you're, 40-something and single. Are you heartened about love at the end of all these stories?
Well, and I was curious about in the New York Times piece, the lady in Saipan, what if you were still in contact.
Yeah, you had a love interest in Saipan, fell hard in love, and just couldn't sort of conveniently get it together and didn't, John. We've just got a minute here. It's not enough time.
Personal part of the interview. It's such a sad thing for me that we're running out of time when we get to this personal part. Yes, the lady in Saipan and I are still in contact. But it is very hard to have a relationship from 9,000 miles away when one of the parties can't leave. Sandra, we had the same sort of experience that you did where we were friends for a long time with nothing kind of weird lurking around inside of us. We just liked to be around each other. We would end up at the same party, end up in the same side of the room, just hanging out. And somehow it went from that to this thing opening up. We're really at 7 o'clock one night. We were having dinner, and we were friends. By 8 o'clock, we were madly in love, and that was it.
And now we're running out of time.
How sad for me.
Well, we'll quote Ortega y Gasset, who you quote in the book, John, is saying the mystic speaks about the presence of God. Does he imagine it? No, he conjures it. And you say, maybe we conjure love as well. That's a piece of work waiting for everybody's attention. Wow. Lots of stories here with all the gnarly detail, and it's really fun to read. John Bowe, editor of the new book, Us Americans Talk About Love. We're grateful to you for being with us this hour. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And Sandra Singh Lowe in Pasadena. It's always great to have you. Thanks for hopping in, Sandra. Great to have you here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.